This morning, America's First News starts right after this.
As a business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This morning, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Helping the Real Warriors campaign. Good morning, I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka on this Thanksgiving Thursday, November 23rd. Glad you're with us, and here's what we have for you this hour.
On a day of giving thanks, we'll explore how to lend a hand to returning soldiers who may need help with things like PTSD.
Ways to make our smartphones more humane and less addictive.
Things you should never do on Thanksgiving, like talk about politics.
And the new surprise airline fee.
There's a new fare class, basic economy, that we've talked about before, and on United and American, it doesn't allow you to bring a carry-on bag. But then it turns out that both United and American have decided to add a penalty on top of that if you do bring the bag to the gate. Mm.
Wall Street Journal travel columnist Scott McCartney on the unpleasant surprise in about 20 minutes. Glad you're with us and happy Thanksgiving. Experiencing psychological stress as part of military life can be common, but the Real Warriors campaign has resources that can help, encouraging help-seeking behavior among service members, veterans, and military families coping with invisible wounds. After surviving a suicide attempt, retired Army Sergeant First Class David Parrish is reaching out to others and joins us now. He's a veteran and suicide survivor. Sergeant, explain the campaign.
We are just engaging a national audience and discussing that, you know, yourself, loved ones, if you're a veteran yourself, that there's resources available to you and that you're not needing to suffer in silence. There's plenty of people who have been down this road and have experienced, you know, same hardships that you yourself might be experiencing, and just really discussing resources that are available to you.
What was your aha moment, by the way?
Well, my aha moment, unfortunately, came after a suicide attempt. So, again, that's why mainly I'm so passionate about discussing that today. I really did internalize a lot of things and tried to hide the depression I was feeling, the suicide ideation I was feeling. I tried to hide that from my leadership. I didn't really engage early, which could have prevented a lot of hardships for me and my family. And that's really what we're striving to do again now, is just encourage people to talk about it. It doesn't mean you're weak. It doesn't mean that you're less of a warrior. Absolutely reaching out for help is a sign of strength. So those are all things that we're trying to get across through the Real Warriors campaign.
I would imagine that's a difficult message to get soldiers to believe, that it's okay to ask for help.
Well, you know, the way to look at it and engage soldiers is to talk about it as though it's maintenance. You know, for soldiers, we're encouraged often to maintain our weapons, maintain our equipment. That is a normal thing in our life. So if you look at your mental health as another thing that you need to maintain, I mean, we do physical exercise every single morning in an effort to maintain our bodies. This is really nothing else. Even if you feel like things might just be a little off, it's kind of like if you feel something is off in your vehicle, you go and get it checked out. You don't ignore it until it becomes a larger problem. Same thing is true of mental health. And just looking at things like realwarriors.net shows you resources that are available to you, shows you vignettes and videos from other veterans who have gone through similar situations, and really gives you that opportunity to see, you know, through other people's stories. And, you know, honestly, everybody has their own individual story, their own individual journey, but maybe something that someone else has experienced shows you that you are not alone and that other people have gone through similar situations before.
All right. We're speaking with retired Army Sergeant First Class David Parrish. He's a veteran, also a suicide survivor. Your suicide attempt was brought on by your depression, I think you said. Was there something that triggered the depression? Say, was it things you witnessed or experienced during your time in service? Is that the connection there?
Well, I mean, I am a combat veteran. However, for me personally, and I think this is a great message for us to talk about as well, my depression was not brought on as a result of combat. It was a lot of building of pressure that, honestly, I put on myself.
Okay.
I really felt like I needed to be the perfect soldier and really just striving to be, you know, perfect in life, which everybody knows is an unachievable goal.
Sure.
You're going to fail. You're going to have setbacks. But they're really looking at those opportunities to grow from those setbacks. And again, I didn't talk to anybody about these things that were going on. I just tried to hold it all in. And eventually, you know, it's just like anything that you keep under pressure and that you don't talk about, eventually it breaks down, or too much pressure builds up and you have an explosion. So, you know, that was my journey into it. But, you know, and like I said, I think it's important that when we talk about veterans that we don't just focus on the combat-related stresses, although all of us have them. But there are everyday life struggles that a lot of us are trying to internalize as well and put on this facade of strength that's constant and that you're not allowed to have hiccups, you're not allowed to have moments of weakness or, you know, not talk to people.
That's great insights. Anything else you want to toss in? I'll give you the last word here. You're the expert.
Well, I mean, ultimately, I think that, you know, the big thing I want all my military brothers and sisters to realize is that there's tons of tools and resources available to you through the Real Warriors campaign, through the 866-966-1020 phone number. You know, and ultimately, again, you know, do your maintenance on yourself before it becomes a problem, you know, and just remember that reaching out is absolutely a sign of strength.
Thanks, David. That's retired Army Sergeant First Class David Parrish. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Glad you could spend part of your Thanksgiving with us. Teens, as you may know, have lower adoption rates than younger children and often wait longer to be adopted, yet they still need and want the love and support of a family. That's part of a new awareness campaign from groups like the Adoptive Exchange Association. More on the latest effort from CEO Camila Bunn, whose organization is based in Maryland. It's called What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Camila, set this up.
The HHS, Health and Human Services, Ag Council, and Adopt U.S. Kids are pleased to be launching a brand new set and series of public service announcements encouraging prospective parents to consider adopting teens out of the foster care system. Across the country, we have over 420,000 children who are in the foster care system, and 112,000 of them are waiting to be adopted. We have a large number of those children who are waiting are teens. So our campaign is focused on finding homes for the children most at need.
Boy, those are big numbers. What for the teenagers, is it the older they get as a child, does it become more difficult to find homes for them?
Well, you know, I think it's a combination of some things. The first being that when people set out on their journey to adopt, often they're considering younger children. And that's one of the things that we're hoping to do with our campaign is really promote the idea of adopting a teenager. I call them the terrific teens because they are really phenomenal young people who are very resilient and truly in need of families. The other misconception that we find quite often, which prevents some people from considering adopting an older youth, is that the misconception that these young people have done something wrong to be in foster care, or they're, you know, have done something, and that is not the truth. These young people are in the foster care system due to no fault of their own. And so we're hoping that the campaign will dispel myths, will have and encourage people and inspire people to envision themselves parenting one of these young people who are really phenomenal and very resilient, wonderful kids.
I know you mentioned before You talked about prospective parents, maybe those thinking of having a child on their own. What about seasoned parents who've, you know, have had a couple of kids already, and I don't know, maybe they're empty nesters and you know, are willing to take one in?
Yes, we are absolutely out there hoping that whether you're married, you're couples, you have children or have no children, that you do consider parenting an older teen and adopting out of the foster care system. We have a website with lots of information. It's adoptuskids.org. So for those who are listening to us and maybe considering it, definitely encourage them to go to our website and read a little bit more about it. If you prefer to speak with a live person, we have professionals who answer our 800 number and are happy and very devoted to the families who contact them to learn more about the process, and they will handhold you, in fact, beyond the original phone call, even through as you're going through the process to adopt as well. They'll support you. And that number is 888-200-4005. And we have folks waiting by the phone to hear from you.
We're speaking with Camila Bunn, CEO of Adoptive Exchange Association, talking about their new awareness campaign focused on adopting teenagers. What would you say is the biggest selling point when, you know, when you get 30 seconds to promote the idea? What do you typically tell people?
I talk about the milestones that our young people have yet to reach. It is true that when you're adopting a teenager, they have experienced other things. You know, they have already walked, they have already talked, you know, they've already gone through those early milestones. But we still need our parents in our lives when we're going off to college, when we're graduating from high school, when we are playing in a ball game and we need someone to cheer us on. And we definitely want to encourage parents to envision themselves parenting a young person. Think about their own childhood and the importance of having someone there to support them. That's what we want for our children. All children deserve a family.
Thanks, Camila. CEO Camila Bunn from the organization called the Adoptive Exchange Association. It's 21 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Coming up next, the new snag at the airport catching flyers off guard. Thanks for joining us. There's a new snag at the airport catching flyers by surprise, the gate service fee. It's not a fee to use a gate, although can you completely rule it out? Here to explain the gate service fee is Wall Street Journal travel columnist Scott McCartney. Scott, what's up here?
There's a new fare class, basic economy, that we've talked about before, and on United and American, it doesn't allow you to bring a carry-on bag. If you do, you have to check it, and you have to pay the $25 fee to check it. Fair enough. But then it turns out that both United and American have decided to add a penalty on top of that if you do bring the bag to the gate. And try and check it. So it will be the $25 checked bag fee if it's your first bag, $35 if your second, plus a $25 penalty. United calls it a gate handling charge, and American calls it a gate service fee. And it's it's really another example of a penalty on top of a fee, kind of like changing a ticket. You pay the fare increase. Fair enough. I'm switching to something that we had a different price, but then the airline is going to charge you $200 on a domestic ticket penalty for making that change. Airlines trying to drive customer behavior. A lot of customers think it's punishing them for simple mistakes or doing things that on every other flight are perfectly reasonable to do. Is really in poor taste.
You gave this example of this guy Vishnu Bhargava and his wife flying from San Francisco to Boston, and basically what, they didn't read the fine print, or just...
Well, yeah, I mean, there's some communication issues here between him and his wife, I think. She booked the tickets, he didn't, so, and he went to check them in. He didn't necessarily know that she had bought basic economy. There are all kinds of warnings on United's website and stuff, but it can be confusing, and reading the fine print is difficult. So he didn't read the small print that says no carry-on bags. They actually had three bags, so he paid for one bag and because of that was able to check in 24 hours ahead of time the night before with United. So it wasn't until, and I'm sure if he had read the fine print, he would have found it, but he didn't. And many of us do things without reading all the terms and conditions. So they show up at the airport, and because they have that one checked bag, they just check the bag, and they're on their way, and nobody kind of intercepted them and warned them. So they get to the gate, and there they are with their basic economy tickets, and each of them has a carry-on bag. And United says, no, you can't bring those bags on, and so we're going to charge you $25 because that's your first bag that you're checking, and plus your $25 gate handling charge. And for his wife, that was her second checked bag, so she's 35 plus 25. So there are $110 at the gate, slide the credit card. He points out quite rightfully that any savings he had from a basic economy ticket long ago evaporated. These things are generally, $25 to $50 cheaper. And they're going to, obviously have to check the bags coming home as well. They now know to avoid the gate penalty. But still, it becomes, it really raises the price of the ticket. This is kind of, it's kind of what Spirit's been doing for a long time. Although not even Spirit charges penalties. Sometimes they skew their fees to drive behavior, but don't hit you with as many true just penalties as some of the other airlines.
Scott, Wall Street Journal travel columnist Scott McCartney, who's based in Dallas. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News, Thanksgiving Day style. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and defense. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today. Thanks for being with us. Welcome into Thanksgiving Thursday, November 23. Glad you could spend some time with us on this holiday. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Coming up this half hour, ways to make smartphones less addictive, adding more of a humane touch to them. Also, millennials using those tracking apps that we use on them. Yeah, they're using them now on us. And things you should never do on Thanksgiving. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Cedar Rapids, Iowa, a once bustling city, was facing all the challenges of former manufacturing hubs across the country when it wrote a 25-year plan to revive its business and residential life. The plans didn't go very far, though, because the Cedar River flooded in 2008. Judged at the time to be one of the worst natural disasters in U.S. history, the flood left 10 square miles, or 14% of Cedar Rapids, including City Hall and much of downtown, underwater. In the years since, though, the city has worked with businesses, charitable foundations, and nearly $1 billion in federal, state, and local funds to transform itself. Here's how from this morning's Jennifer Koschenka.
So in Cedar Rapids in 2008, there was a horrible storm that led to severe flooding. It covered the whole downtown. Thousands of homes were destroyed. And the whole city was really, trashed. But what was interesting about Cedar Rapids is that it's not just that they rebuilt, but that the city kind of wasn't in great shape before the flood. And what happened after the flood was they had to rebuild. And they kind of had this blank slate where they could rebuild from scratch with all this money that was coming in, and they were kind of forced to be creative.
What did the downtown area look like before the flood?
So it was pretty dull. Nobody really lived downtown. You would kind of go to work and you would come home. You know, if you went downtown after 5 o'clock, it would be completely dead. On evenings, it was completely dead. And people didn't live in the downtown area. They kind of lived a little bit farther out, which was, you know, looked a little bit more suburban. And so, yeah, it was just kind of, you know, this old manufacturing, food processing hub. There were some office buildings, but a lot of abandoned meatpacking plants, you know, ironworks plants, and, you know, there's still some life. You still had Quaker Oats, which is still there today and has been there since the end of the 19th century. But, yeah, it was just kind of one of these very typical American cities that had had this sort of glorious past as a manufacturing hub, but had just kind of died over the years as manufacturing has dwindled.
We're speaking with Shandy Race of the Wall Street Journal. Shandy, what got Cedar Rapids back on its feet?
Well, the flood did, as strange as that sounds. And the reason is because after the flood, they had to rebuild. They had to figure out what were they going to do. And they had always sort of had this dream of rebuilding their downtown so that it would be this kind of thriving neighborhood where people would live there. There would be condos. There would be apartments. There would be, you know, trendy restaurants and coffee shops. And you could go out at night and it would be thriving. And, you know, after the flood, they got all this money, federal, state, local money, and they had to institute all sorts of programs in order to encourage businesses to go downtown. And the businesses really did leap in, and so did different charitable organizations and foundations. And so everyone was sort of forced to come together. And when they looked at sort of what they wanted to do, they decided, okay, we don't want to just go back to what we had before. We want to make it better than it was before.
And how did they make it better?
Well, so one thing that the city did is they bought up some land themselves, and they actually developed some of the land. So one example that's somewhat unique is that there was this old dilapidated hotel in the middle of town that was just a complete eyesore. Nobody wanted to buy it. So the city bought it, and the city developed this, you know, beautiful new hotel with a huge convention center, and that's sort of now in the middle of downtown. They also, you know, gave all sorts of tax incentives to different companies to come downtown and build big buildings. And so, you know, you brought more workers downtown, brought more life. And one of the other things was developers started buying up land that had been destroyed that was cheap, and they actually built homes. And so you have now a significant number of people who actually live in apartments, you know, loft-style condos downtown.
That's this morning's Jennifer Koshenko with Wall Street Journal reporter Shandy Race. It is 20 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Thanks for spending time with us. Happy Thanksgiving to you. The newest iPhone may have just enough new features to entice people to pay $1,000 for it and use it a lot. But what if our phones had built-in features to help us use them less? Would you even use those features? Market Watch reporter Leslie Albrecht found some ideas. Leslie, what are some of the experts saying?
One of the things they said was, what if your phone knew to leave you alone when you were busy doing things that required FaceTime, like having family dinner or, you know, being in yoga class or whatever? So the idea is, like, your phone would know, based on your calendar entries, what you were up to at that moment, and it would not send you any messages or interrupt you at all. It would go into kind of like a sleep mode, and you would, you know, you would be able to disconnect for that period.
Mm. Like almost like it would recognize that your kids were in the room, right?
Yeah.
And required your attention or something.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
What else?
And another classic one is auto reply for text messages. Right now, you can't on your iPhone. You can't do this. You can do this on an Android with an app called Little Space. But what it would do is, or what it does is it lets you reply to a text message with a quick auto reply saying like, hey, I can't talk to you right now, but I'll get back to you later.
Yeah.
And the idea is like it trains people to not expect an instant reply when they text message you. And that's another way of like letting people not be glued to their phones all the time because they're always worried they're going to miss something. So that's why people are always like looking at their phones. Mm.
It is staggering that that's not available on the iPhone, isn't it?
Isn't it weird?
Stunning. Yeah. And the phone, you know, phone companies, or I should say the providers, the service providers offer something like that, you know, but you got to go through your provider. It's just weird. There's just not an app in the iStore. I don't even, there must be some conspiracy behind that, that's not there.
Yeah, exactly. And then another kind of funny one is this idea of like being able to program a little inspirational message to yourself so that like after you've been on your phone for a number of hours, a little message would pop up and say something like, is this the best use of your time? Or, remember to be in the moment instead of looking at your phone.
All right. We're speaking with Leslie Albrecht, MarketWatch reporter. Her piece is called Six Ways to Make Smartphones More Humane and Less Addictive. What was the app called Moment that you wrote about? What does that do?
Yeah, so that's actually a tool that you can use now with your phone. It's not a built-in feature, but it's an app that you can download, and it lets you see exactly how many hours a day you spend on your phone and what apps you use the most. And the idea is, you know, it helps you get a handle on how much time you're really spending on your phone instead of doing other stuff.
Wow. How about the suggestion that kind of turned the iPhone ugly a little bit, or your smartphone?
I like that one. I thought that was pretty simple and interesting. I mean, one of the reasons that we like them so much is because they're very beautiful objects and like known as these like icons of industrial design or whatever. But one way would be to make them less actually attractive by having their screens turn like ugly and gray looking so that you wouldn't want to go touch that shiny object.
What was the point someone made about this tool about what you did and what you did not do with the phone?
Yeah, I don't know. This would be a little tough to engineer, but her idea was that, like, you know, there's a lot of times you pick up your phone just to, like, check something really quickly, and then all of a sudden you fall into this giant black hole and emerge, like, 45 minutes later. So she was saying, like, what if your phone could tell you all the times that, like, you were trying to do something with it, and then instead it, like, hijacked your attention and made you do something else instead. It would be like, you know, all the times that your phone made you take a detour.
Thanks, Leslie. That's MarketWatch reporter Leslie Albrecht. I must say, it was a recent update, I think, that came across. So in my car now, when the Bluetooth connects the car system to the phone, I do get a message that says, you will not receive text messages while driving. 13 minutes now in front of the hour. On This Morning, America's First News. Thanks for being with us. Parents have always snooped on their children, right? And smartphones have given them a new way to do it. A Pew Research Center survey published last year found 16% of parents of children ages 13 through 17 used monitoring tools on their phones to track them. My wife and I are among those trackers. We've got a 13 and a 16-year-old. But mom and dad can find themselves outfoxed. It's a story from Wall Street Journal mobile editor Katie Bindley. Katie, what have you discovered?
You know, it's kind of a time-honored tradition that parents have tried to keep an eye on their children, and because they now do it through smartphones, their children have realized that they can kind of turn the tables and track and monitor mom and dad right back, and they're doing so for a variety of reasons, ranging from wanting to stay out of trouble, say, by cleaning up after a party in time, but they also get worried when mom and dad, like, don't answer their phones because they're pretty used to, you know, constant responsiveness. So when their parents don't answer their texts or their calls, they'll get really worried, and then they'll track them to see where they are and see whether or not there's anything to be concerned about.
That's funny. Give me an example of one of these young adults who turned the tables. What'd you find?
Well, in one instance, a kid who, or he's 22, his parents went out of town, and he had helped them sort of get their phone set up like 5 years ago. And he downloaded Find My iPhone, which is meant to be used to find a lost iPhone. But what he did is, because he was helping them, you know, quote unquote helping them, he, you know, took note of their passwords. And then when they went out of town, he was able to log in and track them so that he knew what time he had to have everything cleaned up by and what time all of his friends had to be out of the house.
I liked too, the one young woman you talked to whose parents were away, and she found out they were what, within an hour of returning home from a weekend trip, and when they had told her to clean the dishes and vacuum and all that stuff, and she saved all of that work till the final hour when she knew they were kind of in striking distance.
She did, yes. She had mentioned that, you know, they told her to just keep the house clean all weekend, and she was like, you know, I hate doing the dishes more than anything, and I can get this house, like, spick and span within 1 hour if I put my mind to it. So she just had this very relaxing weekend watching Netflix and YouTube, and then once she saw that they were about an hour away, she got to work and said she even, like, mopped. So.
Wow, that's great. We're speaking with Katie Binley, Wall Street Journal mobile editor. She's written a piece entitled Horrors, Millennials Use Tracking Apps to Turn Tables on Mom and Dad. So we know that kids, young adults, don't like us parents tracking them. Have the parents said, hey, yeah, you know what? I don't like this feeling. Have you encountered any of that?
Everyone I spoke with found it more amusing than anything else, I think, because they were like, we don't really have much to hide. So the people that I spoke with seemed okay with it. But, you know, while I was kind of asking around and speaking with some people who are not actually featured in the story, I did hear from a few people. They were like, you know, it's our right to monitor our kids because we're the parents, but no, we don't want them doing it back to us. So I did hear that a little bit, but for the people that I actually interviewed for the story, it was largely that they were amused by it.
Life 360. That's the one my wife and I use on our kids. That's Wall Street Journal reporter Katie Binley. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Thanks for being with us. Things you should never do on Thanksgiving from businessinsider.com. First, say the food will be ready at 5 p.m. when it won't be ready until 7 p.m. Another one. Bring someone who wasn't invited. Also, make Jell-O salad. It seems like a terribly antiquated dish, says Business Insider, and also has no business calling itself a salad. Same can be said for ambrosia salad. Also, don't bring up politics. Don't undercook or overcook the turkey. Another one on the list, don't come unannounced. Too much risk of there not being enough food. Also, don't talk about how you're ruining your diet. Nobody cares. Another thing on the list, don't eat way too much. Also, don't bring your brand new significant other that you've only been dating for a flash second. Don't bring a different dish than you said you would. Don't wait until the last minute to go to the grocery store. Don't get creative with the menu. And don't serve canned cranberry sauce. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Happy Thanksgiving. Thanks for listening to This Morning, America's First News.